From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the future of a 50th anniversary Woodstock festival is getting muddy. And I visit my favorite bookstore with Max Joseph, whose short film tells us how to read more with so many media distractions.
Books are not content the way that social media and TV shows and movies are content. Books occupy a different part of your life, maybe the part of your life that you meditate from.
And from the Song Exploder podcast, a member of the Cranberries discusses one of the band's final recordings with the late singer Dolores O'Riordan. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. 50 years ago this August, a few hundred thousand hippies flooded the town of Bethel, New York, to watch Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, and the Grateful Dead. Woodstock co-creator Michael Lang has been keeping the brand alive ever since. For a 50th anniversary show, Lang booked and paid for a lineup of Woodstock alumni like Santana and Country Joe, and some new stars, including Jay-Z and Miley Cyrus. But Lang recently lost his main financier, and the show, scheduled for about 3 months from now looks doubtful. Stages have yet to be built in Watkins Glen, about 150 miles from the original site, and permits and ticket sales are still up in the air. I sat down today with Variety music writer Chris Willman, and he explained where the problems with Woodstock 50 all began.
To start with, they never knew whether they had permits for everything, and that affected the capacity. You've got to have permission from the local government to actually set up there, and they've never had that. And so that delayed the on sale, and then once everyone realized that the on sale was not going to take place as planned, then that's when the real rumors of trouble started. And indeed, Dentsu, the financial partner from Japan, pulled out recently because they said, you know, if you don't have the permits, we can't proceed.
So did tickets ever go on sale? Did people actually end up buying tickets or not yet?
No, there's still no on sale. They don't even know how much they'll cost because ticket prices would be conditional on what the capacity is. The lower the capacity, the more you have to charge for tickets to make money.
Who is Dentsu and how do they become associated with this event?
Dentsu is a Japanese company. They've been described as Woodstock's financial partner or ex-financial partner. And Michael Lang, in his letter the other day, said he was always suspicious of them. He doesn't like being involved with quote-unquote corporations, so there's a little bit of a hippie vibe there, like, you know, I knew I shouldn't have gotten in bed with the man, so to speak. But he said, you know, I was told you guys are a corporation with a conscience, so I overrode my best instincts and went with you guys, and then you screwed me.
Do they have any of the things that were missing? Do they have permits now? Are they trying to build the facility, or is everything just on hold?
Everything's pretty much on hold. I mean, you know, no building can take place yet. And Dentsu and Lang keep giving us conflicting stories about whether they have the right to proceed, because Lang is saying they do have a conditional permit to build from the state of New York. Dentsu is saying, no, there's no permit. And in any case, there's no final permit. The thing that makes this all seem really screwy is that even though Lang says they have a conditional permit, they can't be issued the final permit until days before the festival when they test the water, which is a reason a fish festival on the grounds got canceled before. So imagine, you know, setting all this up and then like 3 days ahead of time, oh no, we got some dirty water here, so everybody stay home.
As a music fan, would you have been looking forward to certain acts? I mean, there's Santana, Country Joe, Canned Heat, Hot Tuna, a lot of bands that were actually at the original Woodstock. Was that something that music people were looking forward to?
You know, it's different from the original Woodstock in so many ways. And it just seems like it's going to be kind of a typical festival in that it's a grab bag, you know. And I think, you know, what the original Woodstock had going for it, among other things, is a feeling of community in the audience, that the counterculture felt like they were one, sort of making one statement. And here, you know, if you're going to a festival and you're walking from your car and you're a Jay-Z fan, walking next to a Halsey fan, walking next to a Melanie or Country Joe fan, you're probably not going in of one accord. You may get along great, but there's no sort of common purpose there that's being felt by the audience. So it's hard to say how the Woodstock spirit figures into that.
I think the name Woodstock today means certain things to certain people, but I wonder if it means much to the generation that really consumes most music right now. To 20-somethings and 30-somethings, does Woodstock have any resonance for that generation of music fans?
Yeah, I'm not sure it does, to be honest. I mean, I think when he did Woodstock 94 and Woodstock 99, there was still a lot of carryover generationally. And it's like, okay, your parents went to this. Now it's great-grandpa went to this. and is great-grandpa still around to tell the stories of tracking through the mud? And are they positive stories if he couldn't go to the bathroom for 3 days? But yeah, so I think, you know, with acts like Miley Cyrus and some of the hip-hop acts, you know, there's definitely an attempt to say, you know, this is not your grandfather's Woodstock. But when people can already see most of those acts at other festivals, does it matter?
Even if the 50th anniversary of Woodstock was going to be kind of trying to capture the counterculture spirit of the original, is it inevitable today that you have to have a corporate sponsor, corporate backer, a major concert booker to work with?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Golden Voice obviously is sort of the king of this thing at this point. And so for somebody who only does a festival once every 20 years to think that I'm going to come back in 2019 and this is going to be a cinch looks, you know, kind of like not hucksterish, but overambitious in retrospect. And, you know, I think if he had to do it all over again, maybe he'd realize that there was a little bit too much ego involved.
Is there a chance now that somehow all of this can be fixed, because there's not a lot of time left, and knowing how hard it is to stage a huge concert event like this, is it even feasible?
I mean, I made an offhand remark in the office like, you know, I wonder what Las Vegas odds makers would put about the chances of this. And someone said, hey, that's actually a good story. We should ask them. So we did a story asking Vegas bookies what they thought the odds were. And they said, you know, it's too close to call. We wouldn't take any major bets on this. It's around 50-50. I think at this point, as it goes on, you know, if we were going to place odds on it happening, we might put it more at like 30 or 40% informally, because each day ticks along, there seem to be more problems. And now Michael Lang has just issued this open letter to Dentsu saying that they stole money from the festival. And they've responded in turn saying, no, that was our money and we just took it out of the bank account. And we had the right to legally cancel the festival. April 29th was the big sort of day the bomb dropped on this, when Dentsu unilaterally announced that the festival was canceled, and headlines went out around the world, Woodstock 50 canceled. And then, you know, an hour or two later, you have Michael Lang saying, no, it isn't. And so the public is still confused about whether it's going on or not.
Chris Willman is a music writer at Variety. Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
You bet.
Coming up, Max Joseph made a film that's a love letter to bookstores. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. There's been a lot of talk over the past couple of years about our current era of peak TV. Among the victims of that too-much-to-watch reality and so many other forms of digital entertainment are brick-and-mortar bookstores and, frankly, reading. Max Joseph is the director of a short film called Bookstores, How to Read More in the Golden Age of Media. It's part love letter to some great indie bookstores and part guide to how to put down your smartphone and pick up a smart book. I recently ventured out from the studios here at KPCC to meet up with Max at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena, a personal favorite of mine.
So thanks for coming here.
Yeah.
Let's go in this quiet corner. So a lot of your movie is about helping yourself develop better reading habits. Was that the initial goal, or was the initial goal to help others develop their own better reading habits?
The initial goal was actually just to unpack my love of bookstores. It started with a very vague sense of, I love bookstores. There's something that's so stimulating that turns me on. What is it? And I remember I was up in Seattle and I went to Elliott Bay Bookstore, and I just kind of, that was the breaking moment where I walked in. I was like, I had my camera with me. I was like, I need to do something about this. So I came back the next day with my tripod and my camera, and I just started shooting the shots of the spines and the sections. And then I started putting it together and I said, this is not a movie in and of itself. There needs to be more here. I need to dig deeper, and I need to really unpack what it is about bookstores that I love and what it is that drives me crazy. And it kind of led me to this idea of, how many more books am I going to read before I die? What should I be reading? How can I be a faster reader? And what is currently getting in the way of reading? Specifically, you know, device addiction and news addiction and social media in general. And once, you know, in the documentary, Tim Urban from Wait But Why breaks down. I told him I spent 1 hour a day on social media, which is probably a lie. But you're low, I suspect.
You said you read the news about 20 minutes a day and you're on social media another 30. 50 minutes a day of those things adds up to 304 hours a year, which would be, at your rate, over 30 books.
And just looking at that and visualizing it and actually showing what that looks like on a shelf really made me step back and say, I need to put my phone down and delete these apps and every ounce of spare time really devote myself to reading.
So it's clear that you feel that you want to read more. Why do you want to read more? What's driving your desire to become a more active reader?
So before I made this, I would say that the reason I wanted to read more is because I wanted more wisdom and more information. I wanted to digest more content or important content or the most important content, you know, from the great writers or, you know, the great books that have been handed down from the beginning of civilization. And I felt a lot of anxiety over not having read them. And will my life be as fulfilling and will I be able to realize my full potential as a human being without having read all the books that I'm supposed to read? But after having made this documentary, I actually am a lot more at peace with this. The reason I want to read more books now is because I want to read more. I want to be engaged in the act of reading more, because reading is a form of meditation.
Forced meditation is probably a good thing.
Is that what you feel books are, forced meditation?
They can enable it if you're not disciplined enough to meditate otherwise.
And I never really put that together. And yet, when I think back to the books that I've loved growing up and the ones I really got engrossed in, it is that feeling of being engrossed that is the most pleasing aspect of reading in a lot of ways. And it kind of centers you and it grounds you. And now I want to read more books, not just because of what is contained inside of them, but also as an antidote to the scatterbrainedness and the anxiety I feel about all the content that we have at our disposal 24/7.
We're talking with Max Joseph about his short film, Bookstores, How to Read More in the Golden Age of Content. I'm going to bring in Andrew. Andrew, come over here. Thanks for joining us. Andrew, tell us your name and what you do at the bookstore.
Hi, I'm Andrew. I'm a bookseller at Roman's Bookstore. I've been here almost 3 years now.
So, Andrew, let's just say that you come into work and Max is standing here staring at this array of books. What are you going to say to him and have a conversation that is going to get him to a book that he might be interested in? You can
hold the mic. Andrew is going to be my book Sherpa.
Sure. Yeah, well, usually the first step, I know you've already revealed your hand that you were an English major, so I think that's kind of... that's going to color my recommendations in a certain way. Usually I go for something that, like as you had mentioned, something that you would read for pleasure, but maybe have an experience with the canon. In this case, something like Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. That's another one there if you've never read that. The Moor's Account by Leila Lalami. It's called The Other Americans, which is a totally different... This one, Insurrecto, Gina Apostol, it's...
Okay, so I'm definitely walking out of here with a few books in my hand.
Max, a lot of your film is focused on the idea that given... your pre-film reading habits, you would read how many books in your lifetime?
55 more books from this age to the end of my life.
Okay. You're awake about 16 hours a day. That's 32 half hours a day. It's kind of a lot, 32 half hours, right? Currently, at 1.64 minutes a day, this is what Max allots to reading now. But if you allotted one of these of every day to reading, you will become a major reader who will read 1,000 books instead of 55.
Wait a minute. To read 945 more books before I die, all I need to do is read 30 minutes a day?
A lot of your film, too, is about visiting great bookstores in the world. When you walk into a place as great as Roman's, what does it give you that shopping online doesn't? And how important is that in an era where you can put anything on your Kindle in the snap of a finger to actually come in and browse?
Well, just like reading a book, it's an immersive experience. You walk in and you know, the smell of a bookstore is something that I know a lot of people love. I certainly It's one of those intangible things. Also, people like Andrew are also extremely helpful, and you know, there's not an Andrew on Amazon who can be your book Sherpa. And really, the art, the browsing. You know, one thing that you wouldn't imagine going out to make a film about bookstores is how annoying it is to actually film in a bookstore, because when you have set up a shot and you don't want someone in it, you know, people just spend hours and you just wait there for them to leave. And that could be, you know, 20, 30 minutes. So, you know, getting lost in the bookstore itself is part of the experience.
When you make the argument to other people that you have to make time in your life to read, even though you're not writing books, what is the argument? How do you get somebody excited about reading who may say, ah, there's so much good stuff on Netflix, or I'm going to go see Avengers? What's your pitch to them?
The pitch that I would have made before making the documentary is that books are extremely valuable content, maybe perhaps more valuable in a lot of ways than the social media you're consuming, or maybe even that TV show that you're binging, or that, you know, comic book movie that you're going to see. Like, you're going to get more out of a book content-wise, and that's where the value is. However, now having made the documentary, I would say that books are not content the way that social media and TV shows and movies are content. Books actually occupy a different part of your life, maybe the part of your life that you meditate from, the part of your life that you set aside for mental health, perhaps the gym, you know, sound body, sound mind. That getting lost in a book and really going to that place in your brain is grounding and definitely an antidote to the scatterbrainedness that you get from all the other forms of content.
How would you grade yourself after the film in terms of how much more you're reading, and what are the obstacles you still face?
I'd give myself like a B+, which is pretty good. I've read a lot of books since, and I've really taken a step back from social media. The obstacles I still face are creating the habit, reading the 30 minutes a day or more. When, you know, when are those 30 minutes? But I find that on the weekends, 3 hours, 4 hours on Saturday and or Sunday of reading is incredible. And then 30 minutes at least before you go to bed. And if you can, I even find that 30 minutes in the morning at least is a great way to start the day, especially before you look at your phone. Again, it grounds you in a way that meditating would.
And you're walking out of here with two books, They're There, which I am actually in the middle of reading right now, by Tommy Orange, starts off great, and The Moore's Account, Pulitzer Prize finalist, by Leila Lalami. And are you going to grab something
else? Yeah, I'm going to grab The Library Book by Susan Orlean.
Which is about the fire in the downtown public library, which I actually saw burn down.
And I'm also going to get Where the Crawdads Sing.
Your total is 77.06.
Here we go. Always slightly less than $100. Maybe I can justify this as a tax write-off.
Max, thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here.
Coming up, the Song Exploder podcast breaks down one of the final recordings by Dolores O'Riordan and the Cranberries. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and now the latest episode from Song Exploder. That's the fantastic podcast produced by our friend Rishikesh Hirway, in which musicians deconstruct a recording of theirs. Today, it's a song by the Cranberries. The band formed in Ireland in 1989. Singer Dolores O'Riordan joined a year later, and the group went on to become one of the defining bands of the 1990s, eventually selling more than 40 million records worldwide. In January of 2018, while the band was working on its eighth album, O'Riordan drowned after excessive drinking. She was 46 years old. Later that year, remaining members Noel Hogan, Mike Hogan, and Fergal Lawler announced that the band would dissolve and that their final album would be titled In the End. It was released last month, and in this episode of Song Exploder, guitarist and songwriter Noel Hogan breaks down an album cut called All Over Now.
I'm Noel Hogan from the Cranberries, guitarist and co-songwriter with Dolores O'Riordan. So All Over Now came about. It was actually a conversation Dolores and I had. And Dolores had mentioned to me a couple of nights earlier, she'd seen The Cure live in concert. And she said to me that they play for so long, and half the time it's like these musical interludes, and some of the intros would be like 20 minutes long sometimes even. She said to me, would it be possible for me to look at that and come up with a song that had this kind of long intro? So when we did the song live, she would get a break for a while from singing and rest her voice. I went to France on my own, and I had that conversation we had with The Cure stuck in my head. It was like really, really late at night, and I came up with this chord sequence. It was just four chords that just seemed to glue very well together. So I looped that, and from that set of chords, worked on the guitar line, the main line that runs through the song. I really loved it. It was a real hook, and no matter what else was going on in the song, I thought, that's going to stick in your head. I sent the song to Dolores straight away. So within 48 hours, she sent me back a full vocal for the first verse and all of the chorus. And she had slightly changed the drum beat a little bit as well. Dolores lyrically would write about a lot of things that went on in her own life, but every now and again she'd write a song about a subject that she felt strongly about. And in particular with this song, it's really about domestic abuse. And that's not something that she went through herself, but it was something she felt strong enough about that she put herself in that position. So Dolores sent the first verse and the chorus, and for a long time that's all I had, you know, and I thought, that's fine, she'll work on the rest of it at some point. That was the first week of June, and then Dolores passed away early January.
The Cranberry singer Dolores O'Riordan died suddenly in an hotel in London. The Limerick-born singer was 46 years old.
It had been months since I had visited this song, so I went out to the studio and started going through the hard drive of everything, and we have a verse and a chorus. It's a pity I don't have the rest of it. We would have been able to finish it. Dolores' boyfriend had a hard drive in New York with a whole bunch of stuff in it that they weren't really sure what it was. And so I get the hard drive delivered to me, and suddenly all the bits I was missing from the songs and the rough ideas she'd sent me were all there. She had actually finished them, but just never got around to sending them to me. I've kind of pieced together the other half, the vocal, with the one I had already, and suddenly we have the full version of the song. You know, I can't tell you the relief that I felt, because this was a song that she was really excited about. We were in the studio. There was a bit of a strange situation to be in, with Dolores not being there. That first day was hard. It was hard for everybody to hear her again. I don't think anyone was really prepared for, you put on the headphones and you hear Dolores's vocal.
Do you remember the night at a hotel in London they started to fight?
It's very much just a single vocal for a lot of the verses, and then it goes into the chorus and it kind of sounds like it gets turned into stereo almost all of a sudden. And what it actually is just those layers of her vocals, and she was a master at doing that.
And it's so over now, it's so over now, so over now, it's so over now.
The first day and the very, very last day we went in were the two toughest days. The emotions from the first day of, what are we doing here? Is this going to work? And all those kind of things, and missing Dolores. And then the last day when you finish, it's like it's the end of it. It's the last time we'll be in the studio together as the Cranberries. It's sad, the thought of doing anything else now, it, you know, it doesn't really enter your head.
To hear a longer version of that session with Noel Hogan of the Cranberries, go to songexploder.net. By the way, that podcast is now hosted by Tao Nguyen of the band Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. You can find our podcast wherever you like to listen. That's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.